This is Joe Wagenseller, November 19th, 2004, Individuation.
I made a little outline here of what I will try to cover this evening, because I always find it helpful to have a sense of where I'm going and what I'm listening to. So the introduction will deal with some of the large questions of life, some of the large questions which get responded to in many of the mystery religions of ancient cultures, initiation rites, and spiritual practices of many different cultures and religions. Jung's concept of the individuation process, what he meant by it, something on the first half of life, Jung's understanding of what happens to the development of our personalities during the first half of life, including the evolving sense that we have of who we are, our identity, establishing our place in the world, a sense of direction in our lives, and then some thoughts of other people which complement and fill out. Jung's idea of the individuation process really began quite early in the last century. Later theoreticians further developed it, so we'll hear something about both some non-Jungians like Erik Erikson, whose famous work on identity is well known, as well as some other Jungians, Michael Fordham from London, who discovered the applicability of Jungian work to children and was the first to work with children as young as 4 or 5 years of age from a Jungian perspective, and who got really Jung to consider a much longer view of the individuation process, and Hans Dieckmann from Berlin, Germany, who made some very interesting discoveries and writing. A little something on this concept of the ego-self axis, which actually Edward Edinger was the first to really spell out. And then a section here that I have on creativity and individuation, which basically talks about the creative process, its relationship to our evolving sense of identity, the relationship between our creative expressions and our growing sense of who we are, self-discovery, self-affirmation, and in essence, the discovery, as Otto Rank discovered in all of his work in creativity, that we're really always discovering and creating ourselves. And then something on the spiritual renewal at midlife, picking up what Paul said about the second half of life. This was where Jung started with the individuation process, that it was a second half of life phenomenon. We'll pick up some components of the process, namely the hero myth, which again Otto Rank saw hero mythology as the analog for the development of the personality. The personal myth, Jung's idea, he spoke about the personal myth. Just as often Jung did, he would sort of suggest a little bit of an idea. Somebody else then would pick it up and develop it, in this case, Joseph Campbell. We'll hear more about that. The destiny motif, the sense of an unfolding sense of who one is and what is one's purpose in life, that's very much related to this whole process and the personal myth. And the phenomenon of synchronicity, a concept which Jung discovered and articulated to be a broad, encompassing concept for many parapsychological phenomena, things that were very difficult to explain, but for which he wanted to make a space to explore and think about and understand them. This concept of synchronicity, which very much relates to the destiny concept, the personal myth, the hero myth, and the whole journey. And then the changing attitude toward the psyche, which Jung discovered in his own experience, and which others do as they engage with this second half of life experience, and then finding one's own spiritual outlook. So that's in broad brush what I wanted to cover. And then I made a little diagram here to understand that this is just sort of a metaphor for the ego-self axis. Jung's idea was that at birth, the ego, which he equated roughly with a conscious personality, is embedded in the self. The self is, again, a symbolic term for the whole of what we potentially are and can become. So gradually the ego evolves out of the self. Gradually, in infancy and early childhood, the individual begins to become aware of oneself as an individual, separates out, but one has still access to the whole potentiality of who one is trying to become. Jung liked to use the metaphor of the oak within the acorn for this whole process. Just as the oak lies potentially within the acorn and evolves and grows into a very unique individual oak tree, so the entelechy, to borrow from Aristotle's concept, where this all comes from, really, Aristotelian philosophy, Jung took this idea that there lies embedded within the acorn the image and the potentiality of what that individual oak tree is going to become, albeit unknown what the weather is going to do to the oak tree and so on, but it evolves. And similarly, he thought, each of us emerges from that unique infant that we are at one point, and you can begin to see throughout childhood and the rest of one's life, both the continuity of identity unfolding and becoming, as well as the changes that evolve. Then finally, the ego becomes separated more separated. Hopefully, the conscious personality is able to maintain some connection with the potential for wholeness. But for many of us, there is some breach in that. There is some extent to which we lose some contact with who we potentially can become, either through traumas or through other influences which come between us and our potential wholeness. And it's often those things which cause people to seek to regain themselves, seek to rediscover and reaffirm themselves, either through various life adventures or through some form of therapy. Now, hopefully not insult anyone by telling you things you already know, but not knowing the extent of your familiarity with Jung's work, I'm just going to sort of spell things out pretty much. Jung, as you may know, was the son of a Protestant minister in Switzerland. He grew up with that influence. As a young person, he was always very inquisitive, asking his father about things. As he says in his Memories, Dreams, Reflections, when his father was preparing him for catechism, one day he got to the Holy Spirit, and Jung's father said to him, "We're not going to spend too much time on the Trinity. That's kind of a mystery, and I don't really understand it. We'll just skip that part and move on." Jung was very disappointed. He thought, "My father, this minister, doesn't know about the Trinity." Very disappointed, only to become more so in time, when he would question and challenge his father about the great mysteries of the Christian faith and felt that his father had settled for the party line. That he would tell him the traditional orthodox teachings, but he hadn't really continued to think for himself in any way that might put him questioning the tradition. Jung wanted to question the tradition, and Jung gradually began to think that whatever these experiences have been that result in the great world religions, they were powerful experiences which transformed people's lives, and that that's still going on. He realized that any religious experience, revelation, inspiration, all of the sources of these great world religions were individual experiences, events in which individuals were awakened to certain realizations and they were transforming. So he figured, whatever else religious experience is, it's always also psychological experience because it's the human psyche, individual, limited, subjective, and imperfect, which experiences these things and formulates them into some kind of meaning and teaching. So he became very interested in looking at what is the human psyche's experience of all these different phenomena, and like William James, who wrote his famous work, The Varieties of Religious Experience, Jung studied world religions, symbol systems such as alchemy, astrology, Gnosticism, alchemy, and others, and looked for the large patterns of human psychological functioning that were awakened and activated in these systems. And he called these patterns archetypal motifs. He began to recognize that there were themes like creation, redemption, incarnation, and so on, which ran throughout many of these different groups and religions, and which he felt represented parts of the human psyche, the transpersonal part, that which the ego experiences, but which is what he called to come from the collective unconscious, from the transpersonal part of the psyche. So he became very interested in that and studying that. And he became very interested in what he called direct experience of the psyche, of spiritual awakening. And he was impatient with what he called secondhand religion, which is what he felt was the traditional passed on. You should believe this because it's been part of our heritage for many generations, even if it doesn't correspond with your own personal experience. So that's what led him into more and more his research on the spiritual dimension. And he was not only interested in this, but it became more and more central to his thinking. So that later on, keep in mind, he was beginning to formulate these ideas early in the 20th century when the psychiatric community was very busy trying to establish its professional respectability in the medical profession and was trying to do so by establishing scientific ways of making diagnoses and understanding mental disorders as disorders of the brain functioning and so on. Here he begins to separate not only from psychiatry but Freudian psychoanalytic theory by talking about spirituality, which was a huge breach with Freud and the rest of the earlier analytic community. We'll get more back to that a little later. These questions, some of life's questions, are asked by most of us periodically during our lives. Who am I? Where am I going? What is the point of this life? These questions and others like them are asked from time to time by most of us. Sometimes we think we know the answers. We think we've discovered answers that are meaningful and give coherence to our individual lives, only to discover later on that we're not satisfied with the answers that we've given ourselves, and we go back to ask them again. But who am I really at a deeper level? Am I just my job? Am I just my relationships? Is there something else? These questions and others like them lie at the heart of the ancient mystery religions and their rites of initiation. These rites sought to respond meaningfully to the mysteries of creation, the origin of humankind, the mystery of what it is to be a man or a woman, and the meaning of life. Periodically through our lives, we seek deeper, more satisfying responses. Some people ask these questions so often that they have difficulty committing themselves to a course of life, a committed vocation, relationships, and so on. They have difficulty deepening their roots. Others are reluctant and perhaps even hesitant to ask these questions. They're too threatening. But in a manner of speaking, then, we're revising our senses of identity, purpose of direction, philosophy of life ongoingly. There's a sense in which each of us has a philosophy of life, whether we're aware of it or not. Usually it's partly consciously thought out and articulated. Often it has less conscious components as well. And we become aware of that from time to time. We become aware that we live our lives as if certain things were central and important and meaningful. The well-known Protestant theologian of the last century, Paul Tillich, said there is no such thing as an atheist, really. If you look at how a person lives his or her life, you'll see what their religion is. It may be security, it may be fame, it may be any number of things, but you'll see that consciously or unconsciously, they organize their lives around a particular belief system of what's important and meaningful, and that really is their religion. So similarly, this philosophy of life, spiritual meaning, and so on, is something that we reassess periodically. Jung has suggested that during the first half of life, roughly the first 35 years, much of our time and energy is involved in figuring out, to some extent, who we are, what our strengths and liabilities are, choosing some sort of work, creating a place for ourselves in the world, figuring out our relationships, who's important to us, who we want to commit ourselves to, if at all, who we trust and don't trust, and where we're going in our lives. As we grow up, certain aspects of who we are get affirmed and accepted by our families, by our parents and others, and by the community and the society in which we grow up. We have a sense of what's acceptable, what we're appreciated and valued for, what's affirmed, and what's not affirmed or accepted or awakened tends to lie somewhat unawakened in the unconscious. Jung called these shadow qualities, by which he meant qualities that have not been awakened and integrated and actualized in our sense of who we are. Sometimes these are qualities that are rejected or repressed because they're unacceptable, or we think that they are. Sometimes they just haven't yet been awakened. But whatever they are, they're human capabilities and potentials, and we often later on discover that we're suffering in some way in our lives because we haven't been able to have access to some important value and its energy and purpose, if you will, because we haven't been able to integrate it. So just to sort of thumbnail this very briefly, the idea that all of what traditionally used to be called the seven deadly sins, all of them can be understood as valuable, human, life-affirming potentialities if they're related to, in a certain way, given a certain place and function in our lives, they become energizing, and each has a value. When they're not accepted and lived in a creative way, they become destructive or limiting. And so, I'm getting way ahead of myself here, but in a thumbnail sketch, part of Jung's whole idea about the psyche was that every form of suffering, whatever diagnostic entity it might be, has a symptomatology which, in symbolic fashion, is trying to bring our attention to that part of ourselves that hasn't been integrated, that hasn't been embraced and valued. And so whether it's an obsessional thought that one is troubled by, compulsive behavior, addictive behavior, depression, hysteria, whatever it is, if you look at it non-judgmentally and say, what is the psyche trying to accomplish with this pathological manifestation? What is the value, so to speak, hidden in the symptom? Jung used the shorthand thing that the seeds of the cure are found in the symptom. You look at what it is that needs to be accepted and affirmed and integrated, and it begins to turn around. The energy becomes available for more conscious living. The personality enlarges and is more integrated. The ego incarnates more of the potential self. And there's a realignment of the personality. So this whole process of looking for the value in the symptom, integrating it, Jung called the redemption of shadow qualities. The redemptive attitude toward the shadow quality is then integrated and becomes a value. So just to give a few simple examples of that, and I'll say more about this later, but I'm reminded of someone who came for an initial interview at the Jung Clinic when I was doing those interviews many years ago, and she'd had an experience in another city that she was very troubled by, so troubled by, that she never wanted to have it again. And that's why she was coming for Jungian therapy, to never have this experience again. And what had happened was she was sitting in a park in Boston, waiting for a friend to come meet her and go to lunch, when somebody accosted her. And she fought off this person so violently that she experienced her murderous, violent rage. And she was so distressed by that she never wanted to feel it again, had never felt it before. But she successfully fought off this person. Well, as I listened to her, it turned out that she was really pretty disappointed in her life. She was in a job where she felt unappreciated and undervalued, didn't see where it was going. She was in a relationship where she felt taken for granted and underappreciated. And in short, her whole life had always been kind of lukewarm, unfulfilling, and disappointing. And it was very hard for her to feel that she had any right to challenge or basically try to lay claim for what she wanted in her life. So when I pointed out to her that this very intense, murderous, violent rage was exactly what she needed to embrace and value, bring into her life, and gradually transform and redirect into a more fulfilling life, that was a lot to swallow at that moment, but that was the idea. And drawing from this idea of Jung's, which basically he said was the teleological notion of the personality and of his form of therapy. Teleology is a form of philosophy and philosophical theology which asks the question, what is the purpose of something? What is it trying to become? So Jung would ask this question when somebody brought in a particular form of psychological suffering. What is trying to happen that's manifesting in this maladaptive form because it's not being related to constructively? That would be the way he'd think about it. And I also suggested to this woman that she had a particular version in her life of the Hercules myth. You may remember that Hercules was given the seven labor, the 10 or 12 labors of Hercules, as a punishment for murdering someone. With his unusual power, in a fit of murderous rage, he killed someone. And the punishment was to do these labors. And if you look at the labors, each of them is a civilizing activity. Each of them took his enormous power and energy and put it to task to bring about some sort of civilizing function. And that's basically what I suggested to this woman was the thing to do with all this murderous rage which had been submerged. And there are other stories like this which I'll use to illustrate a little later on. But also in his notion of the psyche, Jung felt way back in the early years of the last century, that the psychiatric profession was too negative. In its effort to diagnose people, it had these sort of pejorative-sounding diagnostic entities that he felt basically did an injustice to people. And so one of his first theoretical constructions was what he called psychological type theory. It was Jung who implemented the concepts of introversion and extroversion, thinking, feeling, sensation, and intuition. And he said, these are aspects of our human functioning that we all have. Some of us naturally tend to be more extroverted, some more introverted, but all of us have the potential for both. And in fact, if you tend to be somewhat one-sidedly one way, you can develop the other side if you want to. We also have these functions. He said, these functions of thinking, feeling, sensation, and intuition are not the only functions, but these are four what he called major ones, which he felt were kind of orienting like the points of a compass. And if you look at them, you can see much of value about how we use our thinking, how we use our feeling function, our intuition, and our senses, and that they are balancing and that they relate us both to the outer world and the inner world. So as well as tending to be somewhat more introverted or extroverted, we also have certain ones of these functions that are stronger or less strong, but again, they can be developed. And they're directly related to what we're good at, what we're not so good at. He introduced this whole idea as a way of looking at the psyche and saying, all of us have this whole range of functioning. Let's not call it all these nasty psychiatric names. Let's just say that there are exaggerations. When you see someone who's diagnosed in this particular diagnostic entity, what it usually is that they're not related to certain parts of their humanity. They're excluding certain parts of who they are. They're imbalanced. And so his idea basically was to help people come to terms with those aspects of their being that they had trouble accepting, to take the redemptive attitude towards the rejected aspects of the personality. You like to use that analogy from the Bible about the stone that was rejected by the builders became the cornerstone of the temple. And this was a concept in alchemy, too, that the undervalued thing frequently becomes particularly valuable. Anyway, a little side on shadow qualities. I didn't mean to go into all that, but that's part of what. Potential, then, is a big word in our culture. We're very interested in potential. What is somebody's potential? We have diagnostic evaluative tests at a young age in which children's potential is assessed. Well, this child is good at that, but not good at this. They might go into this profession or that. Often, important decisions get made at a very young age, maybe prematurely and detrimentally, on the basis of some of these indicators, which are worthwhile, but depending on how they're used. So we're very interested in people's potential. And it's much related to identity. An individual's sense of her or himself begins to evolve at an early age. Oftentimes, children get too limited a sense of who they are. Sometimes parents and families and teachers identify them too tightly with a particular capability or lack of capability, so that it takes a while for them to discover who they are and what their riches are and to value them in a different way. If someone is more of a feeling person, more artistic, more intuitive, and not quite as quick with the thinking function, they may tend to get discouraged or disappointed or to devalue themselves rather than to discover something else. As a part of this potential thing, many of you are probably acquainted with the Myers-Briggs test, which is widely used now in many different spheres to help people get a sense of their assets and potentials. I remember someone some years ago who came into therapy because she, in her profession, at the age of 26, was said to be the first in the country, number one in the country at what she did. And she was miserable, and she hated it. It was computer-related work. She'd gone into the business field because her father told her that's what she should do. And she was very good at adapting herself to business and sales and so on. But she was unhappy. Her initial dream was of a piano with a tongue of flame over it, like the Pentecost tongue of flame. And when I asked her about the piano, she spoke about music and what it had been in her life and how the piano was in storage at her parents' house in another part of the country. Long story short, she's a music therapist today. And that, if you will, spiritual imagery, which connected her again to music, the valuing of music, the valuing her feeling and its expression, the right to find her own vocation in life, she blossomed under that. She just simply opened up and discovered within herself the permission to become her own person and find her own way. Initially, Jung thought of individuation as the task of the second half of life. Having developed a sense of identity, career, and family, and so on, then one went deeper into oneself. And he said, of all those who consulted him in the second half of life, no one was ever cured who did not find a spiritual outlook on life, by which he meant not necessarily an orthodox religion, but one's own individual spiritual outlook. And he talked about what he called the psychological equivalent to a spiritual journey. And that's the subject we're talking about this evening. What is the psychological equivalent of a spiritual journey? For Jung, it meant that which the great world religions traditionally have provided, but in one's personal experience. In other words, as I was saying earlier, to discover in one's own personal life journey those events which are transformative, powerful, meaningful, direct, life-altering experiences, and to be able to embrace them and give them meaning tantamount to a spiritually significant experience. For this woman, the dream of the tongue of flame over the piano was a kind of spiritual moment of awakening and of re-embracing what music meant to her in her life, redirecting her in her life vocationally. Also, what Jung meant about the psychological equivalent was finding a perspective on one's individual life, being able to see one's life as meaningfully embraced by a larger outlook, call it a height direction or a depth direction, dimension, seeing one's individual life meaningfully in the context of the larger world. And so his concept of the individuation process was what he gradually articulated to spell that out. I mentioned that Erik Erikson, later in the last century, developed his whole theory of identity. And I'm not going to go into that now, but it further fleshed out Jung's idea. Jung left it in these very broad terms of the acorn becoming the oak tree, the infant becoming the adult, and the whole, if you will, mystical and non-mystical journey through which that happens, the choices that we make consciously and unconsciously. As I mentioned, Michael Fordham began to apply Jungian work. He was a student of Jung's and then later a colleague in London. He's written a very interesting book called The Mythology of the Soul, in which he presents several different long cases which show and illustrate the individuation process. And he's written other work which talk about individuation in childhood, early individuation patterns in children as young as 5 years of age, in which one begins to see the self manifesting in the dreams and experiences of these children. Hans Dieckmann in Germany wrote a book some years ago called The Favorite Fairy Tale of Childhood. He discovered that many people growing up in Germany had favorite fairy tales. More in Europe than in this country, children tended to be brought up with fairy tales. And what he discovered was that many children had, or many of his adult patients, had favorite fairy tales from childhood. What he discovered as he looked at the fairy tale was that in symbolic form, it held within it what he called the destiny motif for the life of the child. In other words, in the metaphor of the fairy tale, you could see the life tasks that were going to befall that person as his or her life began to unfold, certain challenges and issues. And it was a very intriguing concept. He came and visited the Jung Institute in New York back in the early 70s and talked about this concept before his book was even published. It was quite intriguing. But that favorite fairy tale of childhood, sometimes children's dreams, particularly recurrent dreams or archetypal dreams, often herald the life pattern that's about to unfold. In a book called Man and His Symbols, there's a chapter in which Jung talks about a child's dreams. There were a number of dreams that this young girl had, which were clearly transpersonal dreams. They were dreams that were beyond anything that a person of that age could have experienced. And the dreams had been written up and put into a little booklet and given to her father as a Christmas present. And the father was a physician, brought them to Jung to ponder what they could be about. And Jung saw in this series of dreams a pattern of preparation for death. And the girl died at a very young age. It's a very fantastic and very interesting chapter in Man and His Symbols, if you haven't read it, very moving. It was as if the self then, not as if, it was the self in the form of these big dreams was preparing this child for the changes that were taking place. I don't know whether any of you saw interviews, and if I am moved this evening, just accept it as it comes, because I often get that way now. There was a series of interviews on a well-known talk show of a young boy, Matty. Unusually spiritually mature young boy with a terminal illness. He has since died, but a remarkable maturity and sensitivity at a very young age. As mentioned, Jung often used this image of the oak within the acorn, and similarly, as I also said briefly, we often see in the first days of life in an infant, you get a sense of a little personality there that can't even express itself very well yet, but gradually over the years you begin to see the unfolding, and you see the remarkable continuity of this personality through childhood, adolescence, adulthood, even as that person grows in all kinds of remarkable ways, intellectually and otherwise. You see that sense of who one is, that sense of identity. And Jung, in his studies then of the symbolism of world religions, particularly liked this symbol, which we might call one of the central symbols, maybe the central symbol of the Christian religion, namely that of the incarnation. And he likened the individuation process to the incarnation, in which the conscious personality or the ego, over the lifetime of its journey, gradually incarnates, actualizes the potential of the self. This concept of the actualization of potential originated with Aristotle, and it's all right there in his early philosophy. Later, Thomas Aquinas used Aristotle's philosophy as the basis for his whole largely Roman Catholic theology, which grew out in the 13th century of a Christian adaptation to Aristotle's philosophy. And Jung was very attuned to philosophy, both Plato and Aristotle, and you see in his book on psychological types how he related them both, Plato and Aristotle, to psychological typologies and the value systems that flow from them and the theologies that flow from them. Very fascinating, intricate reflection that he does there in that volume 6 of the collected works. So the whole idea of the actualization of potential it lies at the heart and runs through his idea of the individuation process. Now, picking up further on this idea of the incarnation, he was interested in, Jung referred to this verse in St. Paul's epistle to the Philippians, which is called the kenotic theory. This is a verse called kenosis, which in Christian theology or Christology says that at the heart of the incarnation was God's choice to divest himself of the fullness of his divinity in order to take on a human life and live it. And that, the Greek, the word is kenosis, meaning the self-emptying process. Well, that's what Jung felt analogically also described the individuation process, that gradually the conscious personality limits itself, just as the incarnation symbolically was a self-limiting process. By limiting oneself to a particular time in history, a particular life, place, work, and so on, it's a chosen self-limiting process. And so each of us does that same thing. Each of us, as we grow up, we choose to study certain things, we choose to live in a certain part of the world, do a certain work, commit ourselves to certain people in our lives. We limit ourselves, usually not fully consciously. Sometimes later we think we made mistakes and we make changes. But it's a freely chosen process of self-limiting and commitment, which paradoxically deepens our capacity to live an effective life. One of the pathological manifestations of the resistance to self-limiting is what Jung called the puer complex. And one of his colleagues, Marie-Louise von Franz, wrote a whole book called Puer Aeternus, The Eternal Youth, symbolized by Peter Pan syndrome, the person who resists limiting oneself. This is often an affliction of people, can be male or female, people who are particularly talented and are reluctant to limit themselves by committing themselves to particular choices. And often they have difficulty, and eventually other people often begin to sort of give up on them because they're unable to make commitments in relationships, in work, in anything, because of this fear of overly limiting themselves. And the puer problem has been written about, interestingly, by a number of different Jungians. It's the Jungian way of looking at what diagnostically is called a narcissistic personality. It's the individual's limited ability to give oneself to anything. Anyway, this all relates to the kenotic theory and the self-emptying by choosing to limit oneself. Edward Edinger, in his book, Ego and Archetype, further spells this out when he talks about the ego-self axis and as it manifests that way. I've talked a little bit already about some of what I have here, so a little ahead of myself. I mentioned about creativity and creativity and individuation. People often come into therapy to consult someone because they want to change. They may not realize that they want to change, but they realize that something has got to change. Sometimes they come in because they want their partner to change and figure out how they can get that partner to change. Or they want their circumstances to change. Sometimes people send in their partner to change. You go first, then maybe I'll go. So when that happens, in one way or another, one is saying, my life isn't working. Something about who I thought I was, what I hoped my life would be, isn't working. I'm disappointed, frustrated, maybe worse. Maybe one is desperate. And so one has the challenge then of having to look at why one's belief system isn't working. You could call it, if you will, a spiritual crisis in which, you know, the last four relationships I've been in, people have left me, I've been fired from four jobs. Maybe there's something I'm missing. And so there's that fearful readiness to look at what am I contributing to the way I'm experiencing my life. And it's often a challenge to be willing honestly and courageously to look at what I may be unwittingly contributing and have to reconsider that and make a change. There's much here that I could go off into at greater length. But often when people come in for early in the therapeutic process, they'll say things like, I feel like I've lost touch with myself, this business of the shadow, and what wasn't included. When I was a child, I used to be very imaginative and creative. Up until about fourth grade, I used to write stories. I made plays. We would, in the neighborhood, we would perform these plays, and I wrote poetry, and so, and somewhere along the way, I lost touch with that. Or I used to be courageous, and now I'm fearful, and my life is fear-driven. People recognize that they've lost touch with important aspects of who they were, and they want to regain that. That often brings people in. Others feel they've lost touch with their creativity. Now, there may have been a traumatic event, a sudden death in the family, or some dislocation in the family, or some trauma that happened to them individually, or often it's more subtle. It's gradually certain aspects of themselves were moved out to sort of to the back burner, and they began to focus more on other things. And I'm going to do a little parallel here, just in a broad picture. In ancient Greece, the gods Dionysus and Apollo at one time were worshipped equally. This is to sort of give the mythological archetypal background to personal development. They were worshipped equally at Delphi and other sanctuaries 6 months of the year each. By about the 6th century BC, Apollo was being worshipped 10 months and Dionysus too. Apollo represented the rational, logical ordering process, and Dionysus was the non-rational, intuitive, mystical, ecstatic god of wine. And so you can see the implications. Along with that, as gradually the worship of Dionysus faded and the worship of Apollo grew, the mystery religions and the initiation rites that were at the heart of them diminished, and the schools of philosophy emerged in the 5th century B.C. You have the rational replacing the non-rational, with, of course, a certain price being paid. We have then also in Freudian theory and psychoanalysis the whole development of what Freud called primary and secondary process. Primary process being the intuitive, imaginative, spontaneous coming up of images, associative thought, free-flowing ideas, the source of creativity, and secondary process being the ordering of it, the editing function, the ability to put it into coherent packages, so to speak. So just as there was this process moving from Dionysus to Apollo in ancient Greece, so each of us often moves through a similar process in our growing up, from this primary process, imaginative, creative, spontaneous, artistic sensibility, to a more rational, logical, only using part of our minds and devaluing the other. And often it's when we start drying up in what we've left behind that we begin to look for. It often manifests in terms of depression. People who are living too much from their mind, from their logic, and so on. And they've left out their emotional life, their imaginal life, their creativity, until they begin to feel suffering from it. A phone call, there she is. Well, that begins to get one's attention. And some people have those experiences or notice them a lot more than others. But they begin to happen. So there's this meaningful connection between the inner and the outer. Often it happens, when it begins to happen, our sensitivity is awakened to this. Last year I had an experience around the time we were reading this book together. I came out of a CVS pharmacy in the community where we live in Connecticut, and I paused at the curb. A car drove up, stopped, a woman got out, came up to me, handed me a magazine, and she said, are you interested in physical therapy? And I said, yes, but maybe not right now. I don't think I need it right now. She said, all right. She got back in the car and drove away. Didn't speak to anybody else. I thought that was odd. Next morning, I'm walking to my office in New York, 86th Street. Woman comes up to me on the sidewalk and says, another magazine, do you want to be saved? I said, yes, but not now. 3 minutes later, I walk into my office. The phone is ringing. It's the director of the Jung Foundation, and she says, we're organizing a week's conference this summer. We're calling it How to Stay Sane in an Insane World. And we got the first 4 days planned. We'd like you to do the last day. We'd like you to talk about keeping the faith. We'd like you to talk from 10 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon about keeping the faith. I felt that I was being addressed somehow by life. Didn't know how, what. So I said, well, let me think about it. I'll probably do something, but let me think about it. Well, this idea of keeping the faith had certain connotations that I didn't quite completely thought about it over the week and said, okay, I'll do it, but I want to call it, how do we maintain our spiritual equilibrium during turbulent times? I'd rather reframe it. And I thought, well, I'll talk about the individuation process. How do you find your own center? And that's what I thought I'd talk about. So I did that. Well, that began to get my attention. And then there's some other experiences which happened. I'll just tell you very briefly what they were. I got a phone call from somebody that I hadn't talked with in 20 years. We'd been high school classmates, later met up again in college. He'd gone to a large 27,000 population college. Partway through it, he decided he wanted a smaller place where he got to know people differently. He transferred to a small liberal arts college where I had been and where we met. And we had one class together. It was creative writing. Hadn't heard from George in 20 years. Called me up out of the blue one day and said, I just felt like being in touch. I was back in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, recently with my wife, and we were driving around. I was showing her places. And I showed her the old churchyard where we used to play football, and I told her about that and was reminded of you and a lot of people. We used to play there. What happened to me after college was I became a social worker, and I became a director of Jewish community centers. And for 20 years, I've been a director of a Jewish community center in one part of the country or another. And one day, a little woman came in, and she said, may I do a display of my paintings? Could I show them here? And I said, yes, why not? Do that. So he did. And as she was setting up the paintings, he looked at them, and he was very moved and touched by this woman and her work, and he commented on it. And she said, you know, you are unusually artistic in your sensibility. She said, you ought to listen to that. You ought to pay attention to your inner artist. And she said, you know, you're a big guy. You don't have to worry about being effeminate or something. Just embrace your artist. You know, go do it. He said, So here I am now, I'm out in San Francisco, I have my own art gallery, all because of that conversation. Well, within a week I got a phone call from my oldest friend. We've been friends since we were five. His father was the organist at the church where my father was the minister, and we've just been in touch. Our paths have crisscrossed now and then. He called me up to tell me that his mother had died that week. He just wanted me to know. He had shown up at my mother's funeral, was there, came to the grave. Oh, it was just there. So I said, well, let me know when it's going to be, and I'll be there. He said, really? I said, sure. So he calls me up later, and he says, well, as long as you're coming, will you do the funeral? I said, well, sure, of course, I will. Think about it. Let me know what you want, and we'll do that. Calls me back a little later. He says, well, you know, although my dad was an organist and choir master in these Christian churches, Mom was Jewish, and not only that, but she wasn't really practicing, and she was really more of a humanist. And my younger sister thinks absolutely this should not be a Christian funeral, and in fact, probably shouldn't even be a religious funeral. You still willing to do it? Okay. I thought about this woman. I thought about her. Well, her spirituality was her artistic sensibility. This woman. And I took that phrase from Keats, Ode to a Grecian Urn, beauty is truth and truth beauty, all we know on earth and all we need to know. And I used that, talked about her. Well, wouldn't you know, she was the woman that talked George into. So I told that story, told other stories about her. People started standing up, telling stories about her. And I won't go into it more because I'll just not be able to cope. Very moving. Little woman, not 5 feet tall, who courageously stood up and challenged hundreds of people in the middle of a concert about their their prejudicial treatment. Stopped an entire concert, spoke to them, quieted everybody down as an example. Just this, her spirit was phenomenal, who she was. When I graduated from seminary, I was not so sure. While I was in college, my father died suddenly before my senior year. I didn't know where I was going from there. I'd been studying philosophy, but my path was uncertain. But I, walking along the river one day, within a week after he died, I put this metaphor to myself. Knowing nothing of Jung at the time, I said, I'll walk in my father's footsteps in the hope that they will bring me into relation to my heavenly father, and out of that I'll find my who I am and what is my purpose in my life. And with that as a kind of sense of direction, I went on to seminary. Not sure of what I was going to do with it. When I graduated from seminary, I was offered a position in Richmond, Virginia, where the committee who hired me said, well, with your work, would you be willing to take on a ministry to a small group of about a dozen non-hearing people and work with them? We'll send you to Gallaudet College and learn sign language, conduct services for them in sign language, minister to them. It'll be a quarter of your work. Well, I did that and got started, and within several months, word got around in the deaf community about this this group, weekly services in sign language, and a monthly social gathering with a potluck dinner and a social event. By the end of the first year, we had 60 families of non-hearing people with their children. And I was doing a lot of advocacy work and got involved in the Governor's Commission for the Handicapped and lots of things I won't go into now. But where, again, the synchronicity theme here was that in the Episcopal Church, at the end of a certain period of time, there are two levels of ordination. I had been ordained as a deacon. I was about to be ordained as a priest. I was working with this congregation. And I had a series of three dreams, which, though I knew nothing about them at that time, I instinctively felt that they were telling me not to be ordained at this time. That if I did that, I would be taking a step that in some way would violate me. That's how I understood them. I was preparing a sermon on Pentecost in sign language, and I thought, well, what was Pentecost in the first century? And I did this research. If I'd been preaching to the congregation upstairs verbally, 1,200 people on a Sunday morning, I would have thought I knew what I was talking about. I would have just preached a Pentecost sermon, and that would have been that. But I was challenged by trying to figure out how to make signs for this sermon to this congregation of people who had some difficulty with abstract thinking, people who've been deaf from birth. Their thinking and their conceptualization is a little different. So I was working hard on this, and I did this research into what was Pentecost in the first century, because it was already functioning. It wasn't new with the Christian experience. It was a Hebrew experience. It was a celebration 50 days after Passover, the giving of the law to Moses. So I figured these followers of Jesus were still in fear, hiding out in the upper room 50 days, celebrating the giving of the law to Moses, probably in connection with a celebration of the Last Supper, which they'd been asked to do. Somehow out of the relationship of those two things, celebration of the giving of the law to Moses, considering themselves good first century Jews, also celebrating this Eucharist, something came upon them, something transformed. And I thought it had to do with the realization that the spirit of this person was the fulfillment of the law and was available to them. And that was the Pentecost experience, that dropping of the realization, something. Anyway, that's where I came out with it, rightly or wrongly. And I began to think, well, that's a whole other way of looking at that for me. And then I thought even more clearly I needed time to think about this. So I chose to not be ordained as a priest at that time. And I went away on an open-ended leave. And I went to this conference called the Apple and the Silver Cord, which I'd heard about. And it was a series of conversations between the president of the Jung Foundation in New York and a theologian about the mythology of the Garden of Eden story. And as I listened to that, thought about it, talked with people, began to get a sense of a more symbolic approach to some things that I felt obliged to take too concretely, things began to shift a little for me, that kaleidoscopic shift. And two people that I met at this weekend conference invited me to visit with them on vacation. So I did. I went along. I was free, and I went along to Bailey Island in Maine, and there I met Esther Harding, and I had my first two analytic hours with her. And very quickly, in two sessions and a couple of dreams we discussed, she was able to put her finger on where some of my conflicts were and help me to see a way through them. So I returned to Richmond after this and was ordained and went on. And the next summer I went to a conference in New York that was put on by the Jung Foundation. It was a conference where Jungian concepts were being presented for people involved in religious education of one form or another. Many people were there from all over this country and Canada. And during that week, Esther Harding presented her work on the psychological significance of the crucifixion. Edward Whitmont presented a paper on the redemption of Satan. Edinger first spoke about this article on Christ as paradigm of the individuating ego. I was having dreams. Dreams that week, they were turbulent and powerful and getting my attention. And I met people at that week that I've stayed in touch with ever since and who have continued to be very involved in one way or another with Jung in different parts of the world. But I went up to Edinger after that lecture and told him that I wanted to move to New York and get into analysis with him and get into the Jung program, and that's what I did. So that turned my life around, and I continued on with that training. And then some years later, I'll just tell you a couple more examples. This is to weave the thread of synchronicity through. My wife and I were married. We met in Connecticut. And after 8 years, we had not been able to get a family started, and we were saddened about that. And we were starting to think about adoption. Anyway, someone asked me to speak on Pentecost, Mother's Day, that year, 1978. Again, I was being encountered by Pentecost, not with a deaf congregation this time. But this was what was called a corporate communion breakfast for mothers and daughters. Mother's Day was also Pentecost, so I was intrigued by this notion. I was asked to talk about it. So I talked about the uniqueness of the mother-daughter relationship. I talked about Demeter and Persephone. I talked about the motherhood of God, the lack of the feminine in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the idea of the feminine as a form of the Holy Spirit in late Old Testament literature, Sophia, the Sophia literature, and how that got lost. Talked about all of this stuff to this Episcopalian group. It was pretty unorthodox little talk about the Holy Spirit and encountering the Holy Spirit in feminine form and in unexpected and untraditional ways. Jung had once said, "By God, I understand everything that crosses my path, especially those experiences which disrupt my life." So when something would disrupt his life, he would stop and think about it, as George did when the artist spoke to him and others. Well, anyway, that afternoon, our daughter was conceived in feminine form, the feminine form of incarnation. And then a little later that year, while we were expecting her, one day, I was traveling around our little town, putting around brochures of a workshop that a colleague of mine and I were about to do. And I was aware that it was the anniversary of my father's death. And I was thinking about my own coming fatherhood and what kind of a father I hoped to be, how I would be like him and different, all of that. And I was thinking about one of the things that I hoped to be able to do was to make more of a place in the world for my family. And as I was traveling around, my eye caught this building that I passed. And I just registered on it. I passed it many times and never quite caught my attention before. And then I thought a little later on, I'm going to just stop in this real estate place and talk to this woman who is a tennis partner of my wife's about real estate and about this idea that sometime I wanted to start a little center where I could do my work and gather together a group of colleagues and put on lectures and workshops and start a training program and have an institute and do that. And so the woman wasn't there, but her partner was. And when I told him this idea, he's a totally new person to me, he said, "Do you have a few minutes?" And I said, "I do." He led me to this building. Wasn't on the market yet. Well, no sign on it or anything, but he led me right to the building. Said, "It's coming on the market, and I think this is what you're looking for." So I was thinking about doing this maybe 5 years hence, 10 years hence. I went and talked to my wife. We talked about it. And he said, "You know, if you can raise a down payment on this building, I can fill up whatever you don't need. I can rent it out, fill it up, and it'll carry itself. No problem." This is way beyond what I was ready to do, but within an hour I committed myself to it and did it. And, you know, we got it started, and that's this little center in Connecticut called the Temenos Institute, the place that we started. Well, I just share those experiences. I know we're at our pausing time, but they're some of my experiences of learning to listen to and be interrupted in life and take new joint ventures and try to attune myself to that synchronicitous unfolding. Thank you. Thank you all very much.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.